Love by Guy de Maupassant. Read by Joseph Eyre.
I have just read among the general news in one of the papers a drama of passion. He killed her, and then he killed himself, so he must have loved her. What matters he or she? Their love alone matters to me, and it does not interest me because it moves me or astonishes me, or because it softens me or makes me think, but because it recalls to mind a remembrance of my youth, a strange recollection of a hunting adventure, where love appeared to me as the cross appeared to the early Christians, in the midst of the heavens. I was born with all the instincts and the senses of primitive man, tempered by the arguments and the restraints of a civilized being. I am passionately fond of shooting, yet the sight of the wounded animal, of the blood on its feathers and on my hands, affects my heart so as almost to make it stop. That year the cold weather set in suddenly towards the end of autumn, and I was invited by one of my cousins, Carl de Rauville, to go with him and shoot ducks on the marshes at daybreak. My cousin was a jolly fellow of 40, with red hair, very stout and bearded, a country gentleman, an amiable semi-brute, of a happy disposition, and endowed with that Gallic wit which makes even mediocrity agreeable. He lived in a house, half farmhouse, half chateau, situated in a broad valley through which a river ran. The hills right and left were covered with woods, old manorial woods where magnificent trees still remained, and where the rarest feathered game in that part of France was to be found. Eagles were shot there occasionally, and birds of passage, such as rarely venture into our overpopulated part of the country, invariably lighted amid these giant oaks, as if they knew or recognised some little corner of a primeval forest which had remained there to serve them as a shelter during their short nocturnal halt. In the valley there were large meadows watered by trenches and separated by hedges. Then, further on, the river, which up to that point had been kept between banks, expanded into a vast marsh. That marsh was the best shooting ground I ever saw. It was my cousin's chief care, and he kept it as a preserve. Through the rushes that covered it and made it rustling and rough, narrow passages had been cut, through which the fat-bottomed boats, impelled and steered by poles, passed along silently over dead water, brushing up against the reeds and making the swift fish take refuge in the weeds, and the wild fowl, with their pointed black heads, dive suddenly. I am passionately fond of the water, of the sea, though it is too vast, too full of movement, impossible to hold, of the rivers, which are so beautiful, but which pass on and flee away, and above all of the marshes, where the whole unknown existence of aquatic animals palpitates. The marsh is an entire world in itself on the world of Earth, a different world, which has its own life, its settled inhabitants and its passing travellers, its voices, its noises, and above all, its mystery. Nothing is more impressive, nothing more disquieting, more terrifying, occasionally, than a fen. Why should a vague terror hang over these low plains covered with water? Is it the low rustling of the rushes, the strange will-o'-the-wisp lights, the silence which prevails on calm nights, the still mists which hang over the surface like a shroud? Or is it the almost inaudible splashing, so slight and so gentle, yet sometimes more terrifying than the cannons of men or the thunder of the skies, which makes these marshes resemble countries one has dreamed of, terrible countries, holding an unknown and dangerous secret? No, something else belongs to it. Another mystery, profounder and graver, floats amid these thick mists, perhaps the mystery of the creation itself. For was it not in stagnant and muddy water, amid the heavy humidity of moist land under the heat of the sun, that the first germ of life pulsated and expanded to the day? I arrived at my cousin's in the evening. It was freezing hard enough to split the stones. During dinner, in the large room whose sideboards, walls and ceiling were covered with stuffed birds, with wings extended or perched on branches to which they were nailed, hawks, herons, owls, nightjars, buzzards, tiercels, vultures, falcons, my cousin, who, dressed in a sealskin jacket, himself resembled some strange animal from a cold country, told me what preparations he had made for that same night. We were to start at 3:30 in the morning, so as to arrive at the place which we had chosen for our watching place at about 4:30. On that spot a hut had been built of lumps of ice, so as to shelter us somewhat from the trying wind which precedes daybreak, a wind so cold as to tear the flesh like a saw, cut it like the blade of a knife, prick it like a poisoned sting, twist it like a pair of pincers, and burn it like fire. My cousin rubbed his hands. "I have never known such a frost," he said. "It is already 12 degrees below zero at 6 o'clock in the evening." I threw myself onto my bed immediately after we had finished our meal, and went to sleep by the light of a bright fire burning in the grate. At 3 o'clock he woke me. In my turn I put on a sheepskin, and found my cousin Carl covered with a bearskin. After having each swallowed 2 cups of scalding coffee, followed by glasses of liqueur brandy, we started, accompanied by a gamekeeper and our dogs, Plongeon and Pierrot. From the first moment that I got outside, I felt chilled to the very marrow. It was one of those nights on which the earth seems dead with cold. The frozen air becomes resisting and palpable. Such pain does it cause. No breath of wind moves it. It is fixed and motionless. It bites you, pierces you through, dries you, kills the trees, the plants, the insects, the small birds themselves, who fall from the branches onto the hard ground and become stiff themselves under the grip of the cold. The moon, which was in her last quarter and was inclining all to one side, seemed fainting in the midst of space, so weak that she was unable to wane, forced to stay up yonder, seized and paralysed by the severity of the weather. She shed a cold, mournful light over the world, that dying and wan light which she gives us every month at the end of her period. Carl and I walked side by side, our backs bent, our hands in our pockets, and our guns under our arms. Our boots, which were wrapped in wool so that we might be able to walk without slipping on the frozen river, made no sound, and I looked at the white vapour which our dog's breath made. We were soon on the edge of the marsh, and entered one of the lanes of dry rushes which ran through the low forest. Our elbows, which touched the long ribbon-like leaves, left a slight noise behind us, and I was seized, as I had never been before, by the powerful and singular emotion which marshes cause in me. This one was dead, dead from cold, since we were walking on it, in the middle of its population of dried rushes. Suddenly, at the turn of one of the lanes, I perceived the ice hut which had been constructed to shelter us. I went in, and as we had nearly an hour to wait before the wandering birds would awake, I rolled myself up in my rug in order to try and get warm. Then, lying on my back, I began to look at the misshapen moon, which had 4 horns through the vaguely transparent walls of this polar house. But the frost of the frozen marshes, the cold of these walls, the cold from the firmament, penetrated me so terribly that I began to cough. My cousin Carl became uneasy. "No matter if we do not kill much today," he said. "I do not want you to catch cold. We will light a fire." And he told the gamekeeper to cut some rushes. We made a pile in the middle of our hut, which had a hole in the middle of the roof to let out the smoke, and when the red flames rose up to the clear crystal blocks they began to melt, gently, imperceptibly, as if they were sweating. Carl, who had remained outside, called out to me, "Come and look here." I went out of the hut and remained struck with astonishment. Our hut, in the shape of a cone, looked like an enormous diamond with a heart of fire, which had been suddenly planted there in the midst of the frozen water of the marsh. And inside we saw 2 fantastic forms, those of our dogs, who were warming themselves at the fire. But a peculiar cry, a lost, a wandering cry, passed over our heads, and the light from our hearth showed us the wild birds. Nothing moves one so much as the first clamour of a life which one does not see, which passes through the sombre air so quickly and so far off, just before the first streak of a winter's day appears on the horizon. It seems to me, at this glacial hour of dawn, as if that passing cry which is carried away by the wings of a bird is the sigh of a soul from the world. "Put out the fire," said Carl. "It is getting daylight." The sky was, in fact, beginning to grow pale, and the flights of ducks made long, rapid streaks which were soon obliterated on the sky. A stream of light burst out into the night. Carl had fired, and the 2 dogs ran forward. And then, nearly every minute, now he, now I, aimed rapidly as soon as the shadow of a flying flock appeared above the rushes, and Pierrot and Plongeon, out of breath but happy, retrieved the bleeding birds, whose eyes still, occasionally, looked at us. The sun had risen, and it was a bright day with a blue sky, and we were thinking of taking our departure, when two birds with extended necks and outstretched wings glided rapidly over our heads. I fired, and one of them fell almost at my feet. It was a teal with a silver breast, and then, in the blue space above me, I heard a voice, the voice of a bird. It was a short, repeated, heart-rending lament, and the bird, the little animal that had been spared, began to turn round in the blue sky, over our heads, looking at its dead companion which I was holding in my hand. Carl was on his knees, his gun to his shoulder, watching it eagerly, until it should be within shot. "You have killed the duck," he said, "and the drake will not fly away." He certainly did not fly away. He circled over our heads continually, and continued his cries. Never have any groans of suffering pained me so much as that desolate appeal, as that lamentable reproach of this poor bird which was lost in space. Occasionally he took flight under the menace of the gun which followed his movements, and seemed ready to continue his flight alone, but as he could not make up his mind to this, he returned to find his mate. "Leave her on the ground," Carl said to me. "He will come within shot by and by." And he did indeed come near us, careless of danger, infatuated by his animal love, by his affection for his mate, which I had just killed. Carl fired, and it was as if somebody had cut the string which held the bird suspended. I saw something black descend, and I heard the noise of a fall among the rushes, and Piero brought it to me. I put them, they were already cold, into the same game bag, and I returned to Paris the same evening.
You've been listening to Love by Guy de Maupassant, a BBC Radio Drama Company production read by Joseph Eyre. The producer was Karen Holden.